WJZ, New York. The March of Time.
A report from the publisher of Life.
As Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, goes into 1938, what was once a theory and experiment has now become an established American institution.
Reporting on Life as a business institution.
More than $10 million in new capital has been invested in Life by its publishers, its printers, its papermakers. More than 2,500 men and women have found new regular jobs, new annual salaries in the various phases of Life's production. In Life, 50,000 U.S. news dealers have found a new source of profit. Their biggest single source of profit on the newsstand. Far more money is being paid over U.S. newsstands for Life than has ever been paid for any other periodical, weekly, monthly, or semi-monthly. Already, U.S. advertisers have signed up for more advertising dollars in Life in 1938 than they spent in Life in the entire year, 1937. For in 1 year, they have discovered how efficient Life is in helping to distribute the products of industry.
Life influences the thought and actual lives of many people. Best evidence of the high standard of Life's pictorial journalism is the confidence which millions of readers have in what Life shows and tells them. For in using pictures first and foremost to inform, Life has made pictures not only a powerful, but a responsible new arm of journalism. Next Thursday night, the March of Time is moving up 1/2 hour. It will be heard on these same stations, but at 8 o'clock, instead of 8:30, starting next week.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time. Washington, D.C. One afternoon this week, up to the curb before the White House office building, draws a taxi occupied by the most strangely assorted group of White House callers since the hectic days of the Brain Trust. For out steps CIO bosses John L. Lewis and Philip Murray, arm in arm with J.P. Morgan partner Thomas Lamont.
I've got it, Mr. Lewis. I'll pay the fare.
Oh, no. This one's on the Committee for Industrial Organization, Mr. Lamont. How much, driver?
2 bits, Mr. Lewis.
25 cents, huh? Got a quarter on you, Phil?
Now here, Mr. Murray.
Well, you wouldn't spoil my fun, would you, Mr. Lamont? It's always been my life's ambition to pay a taxi fare for a Morgan partner.
Arm in arm into the White House office building march Morgan partner Lamont and CIO partners Lewis and Murray to attend behind closed doors a conference of economic royalists and liberal businessmen, of labor leaders and financiers. And all afternoon, outside Presidential Secretary Stephen Early's office, news hawks await conference's end.
It's been nearly 2 hours.
Yeah. There goes Steve Early now, headed for the president's office.
The conference must be ready to break up.
Yeah.
I tell you, Mr. President.
Hey, listen.
This is central to the program that will be
Did you hear that? Yeah, first time I've ever heard talk like that in the president's office.
Sounds like the president's doing all the listening today. Here they come now. Mr. Young, what did the president say?
I have no statement to make at this time, gentlemen.
Here comes Thomas Lamont.
Mr. Lamont, any statement on the presidential conference?
I think my friend, Mr. John L. Lewis, has been selected as spokesman. That right, John?
Yes. The president and the rest of us talked about the recession, gentlemen. The recession and how to end it. We were all agreed on one thing, that the president should formulate and announce a definite program.
Are you all agreed on a program? Business and labor, I mean.
The program is up to the president. But business and labor both asked for action, immediate, clear-cut action by the administration here in Washington.
But presidential action following this week's White House conferences is not the kind of action expected by capital and labor's new opportunist coalition. But Franklin Roosevelt promptly angers business by proposing a ban on all holding companies. Angers organized labor with a hint that wages are too high in certain industries. Surprises both sides by the appointment of middle-of-the-road Solicitor General Stanley Reed to the Supreme Court. Comments pundit Hugh Samuel Johnson,
The president pats people on the back with his right hand and throws pepper in their faces with his left. Reminds me of the Duchess and the baby in Alice in Wonderland. I speak severely to my boy. I beat him when he sneezes, for he can thoroughly enjoy the pepper when he pleases.
1938, marches on. Madrid, Spain. Early one morning this week, at a Genoa Street intersection in Madrid's Ventas district, a swarthy middle-aged man in workman's clothes approaches a civil guard who stands at the subway entrance.
This station is closed, senor. Drive the central terminal, 4 blocks north.
But I am an electrician for the metro system. Here is my identification.
My orders are to let no one go down in the subway, this entrance. This station has been closed.
This is an emergency, officer. Look, I have a special credential.
Ministry of Transport. Well, all right, but be quick about it.
I won't be long, officer. Thank you.
Hernandez.
Yes, Luke.
Who is that man you just passed?
The electrician. He had a special pass from the Ministry of Transport.
Special pass? Sergeant.
Yes, sir?
We take a squad of men down into the station. Search every corner of it. Someone has gotten down there. Every corner, you understand?
Yes, sir.
But, Lieutenant, his pass...
Never mind. Run to the central subway terminal. There is a train due to leave there in a minute or two for this station. That train must be stopped. Run. You hear me?
Run.
Six minutes later, in the Madrid central terminal, a uniformed guard rushes down the stairs, reaches the platform at the doors of a 7 a.m. train are closed. The cars move forward, gaining momentum.
Hey! Hold the train! Stop! Somebody stop that train!
What is the problem?
Are you the dispatcher?
Yes.
You've got to stop that train.
But what has happened?
Don't ask questions. Put on the stoplight between here and Genoa Street. Phone the other terminals. Hurry!
In the cab of the train speeding through the dark tunnel toward Genoa Street.
We got time? Little late. Make it up. Hey, look. The stop signal up ahead.
Ah, that is only for the Genoa Street station. It's closed today.
Oh? Why is that?
They've stored munitions there. TNT, dynamite, tons of it. You'll see as we pass.
Ramon! Up ahead, on the tracks. Pull on the brakes. Steering, heavy.
Ramon, you said that Genoa Street.
The munitions! We must warn the passengers.
Woodman, what is it?
Never mind. Leave the train, all of you. Get here and take it to the street station.
This week in Madrid, in an explosion devastating 4 square blocks of the Ventas district, crumpling 2 subway trains, death comes to more than 1,000 loyalist civilians. And this week, as Madrid police round up 153 fascist sympathizers charged with plotting the explosion, Kurd drama is a faction not noted in the news since the first weeks of the Spanish Civil War. The so-called fifth column of General Francisco Franco, whose operations... in the space of less than 1 minute this week, have cost more loyalist lives than a month of bombardment by the fascist artillery outside Madrid. Time marches on.
Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, in a great castle on a high hill, there lived a princess with a skin as white as snow and lips as red as roses.
And thus do all good fairy stories begin. And thus this week begins a Manhattan premiere at Radio City Music Hall. For this week, brought to life by Walt Disney as a 7-reel animated color cartoon, is the old German folk tale that has charmed children of every land for 200 years. Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. On the screen, the childlike Disney princess, with lips as red as roses and hair as black as ebony. The forest where trees like gaunt old women reach out with bony, clutching hands. The cottage and the tiny bedroom where Snow White falls asleep. Then the 7 chubby faces, the 7 noses like red putty of the 7 Disney dwarfs.
Gosh, what a bunch of...
What is it?
Look out. It's moving.
Why? It's a girl. She's waking up.
Oh. Why, you're a little man. How do you do?
How do you do what?
Now, don't tell me who you are. Let me guess. I read your names on the foot of your bed. Now, you're Doc.
Yeah. That's true.
And you're... Oh, you're bashful.
Oh, gosh.
And you... You're sleeping.
Oh, it's your guess.
And you... You're sneezing. Yes, and you must be...
I'm happy, ma'am. That's me. And this is Dopey. He don't talk none.
You mean he can't talk?
He don't know. He never tried.
On the screen, yellow smoke swirls in a castle dungeon. A worried comic Disney crow watching a hideous green-eyed Disney witch. A steaming, bubbling cauldron.
Yeah. Boil, cauldron, boil. Boil, cauldron, boil. Step within your depths, I see. For one who dares to rival me, brew the magic recipe, boy, you cauldron, boy, you
lie. Morning light in a forest that is terrifying no more. The antic troop of Disney animals in human pantomime. The buck-toothed rabbit, the anxious turtle, Snow White standing at the forest's edge with the Disney dwarfs.
Now, don't forget, my dear, that the old Sleen's a cry one. I mean, the old Queen's a sly one, full of witchcraft. So beware of strangers.
Don't worry. I'll be all right. Goodbye.
Hi-ho, 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 hi-ho. It's off to work we go. Hi-ho!
Such is the ancient German fairy tale, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, peopled with the quaint characters of a 20th century animated cartoon. 15 years ago, a 22-year-old youth named Walter Disney began to experiment with a new technique in motion pictures. Brought to life in Disney's fantastic cartoon medium, Mickey Mouse and a score of other animal creations became universally more popular than any personalities on the screen. And this week, as all day long, hardened Manhattan cinema goers keep filing out of Radio City Music Hall, the bemused smiles still on their faces, comments columnist and professional cynic, Westbrook Pegler.
Maybe Walt Disney has some faults that I don't think about. I've never met him. Maybe he barks at waitresses and snarls at newsboys. But if he does, I hope nobody tells me about it. Because I believe that Walt Disney has created more hours of complete detached happiness for the human race than any other man on earth.
Hi-ho, 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 France, the week of the first 1938 session of Parliament, in the 19th month of government by France parties of the left, famed as the French Popular Front. But this week, throughout the Republic of France,
a room in the Paris Prefecture of Police.
No, wait, I'll tell you. I planted the bomb myself.
Who were your accomplices?
I do not know. They all wore hoods, masks over their faces. We were to kill the leaders of the Popular Front and overthrow the government. It was all going to happen before this week.
Why before this week?
Because Parliament opens this week. We were to start the revolution before Parliament met.
The manager's office in a silk factory at Adome.
But I tell you, you must give me time. You cannot strike when I am...
There's no time, there's no time. Unless you grant our demands, we strike today.
But why? It is unreasonable.
Parliament meets in 3 days. Who knows what new labor policy the government will have next week? There is no time for directors' meetings now.
Paris, the office of Premier Camille Chautin.
In his office, the Premier is conferring with head of the all-powerful Bank of France, Pierre Fournier.
I cannot help what the election promises of the Popular Front were, Monsieur Chautin. You must go before Parliament with a program of drastic reduction in government expenditure so that the budget can be balanced.
And what am I to tell the parties of the left to cry for more reforms, more expenditures?
Tell them the truth. Tell them that France is facing bankruptcy.
Amid a welter of revolutionary plots and counterplots, widespread strikes and disorders, social reform and political upheaval, this week in a turbulent Chamber of Deputies opens the first session of the 1938 Parliament.
Order! Order! Messieurs! Monsieur Chautin has the floor. The Premier has the floor.
Messieurs, I beg of you to consider the very serious nature of the problems confronting us. We must abandon parties and platforms. We must have unity in this crisis.
Unity! Unity! The working class starves, and you talk of unity. What is your program? Does the Premier have a program?
Messieurs, there is but one workable program for France today. Reduce government expenditures, balance the budget, enforce industrial peace, pass labor laws.
Monsieur le Président! This plan is nothing more nor less than a betrayal of the working class. The Premier offers a plan of reaction. We were elected on a program of social reform.
Do the communist plan to save France by ruining her industries? If the communists want their freedom of action, I give it to them. I will let the government fall, but I will not let the communists spit in my face.
One hour later, deserted by a majority of the left, the Popular Front government of Camille Chautin collapses.
London, number 10 Downing Street, the residence of Britain's Prime Minister.
In his study, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain sits with the telephone held to his ear, nervously drumming on the desktop.
Here is your Monte Carlo call, Mr. Chamberlain. Go ahead.
Are you there? Hello. Hello, Miss Reardon.
Yes.
This is Neville Chamberlain. Sorry to disturb your holiday. I've just been informed the French cabinet has fallen.
Been in any trouble?
Not yet.
Of course, I'll get the first plane I can. Be back in the morning.
For 5 days this week, Democratic France is without a government. One after another, France's ablest statesmen attempt to form a new cabinet, attempt to reform the shattered ranks of the Popular Front, without success. Strikes and industrial disorders continue to spread. On international exchanges, the franc drops to its lowest point in 11 years. On the sixth day, former Premier Chautin is summoned to the Elysee Palace of France's President Albert Lebrun.
Monsieur Chautin, I have called you because it is imperative that you attempt to form a new cabinet.
I have failed once, Monsieur le President.
You cannot fail now, Monsieur. If you do, we face a nationwide election. A popular election in France now will lead to violence, bloodshed, perhaps more. Well, Monsieur Chautin?
Very well, Monsieur le Président. I will try to form a new cabinet.
At week's end, Camille Chautin returns to the premiership of a shaky coalition government of liberals and conservatives. But from Paris, reports New York Times correspondent P.J. Phillips,
in the opinion of many competent observers, events have come to the point where the present crisis can be solved only by a dictatorship, either of the right or of the left. If that is the case, then the present session of the Chamber of Deputies will be the last democratic parliament in the Republic of France.
Time marches on. City.
Young man, do you usually raise your hat to a lady? Do you feel it is polite to do so?
Well, I used to, but nobody seemed to pay no attention, so I kind of got out of the habit.
week, under the auspices of the WPA and New York City's Junior Inspection Club, is rounded out a copious survey of etiquette among 1938 youngsters, based on answers given by children of all social classes and aged from 6 to 18 to some 50 searching questions.
Question: do you use sir or ma'am when addressing older people?
Ninth Avenue answer.
Well, I tell you, it's all right for some guy at Annapolis or West Point to say sir, but sounds kind of sissy for a guy that just lives in New York.
Answer in the fashionable 50s.
I've only heard servants use sir and ma'am. I don't think children ought to say it.
Question: do you open the door for your father and mother?
Answer in Little Italy.
For sure I open the door. Most of the time they carry packages in both hands and can't get at it.
Answer on Upper Fifth Avenue.
Oh, goodness, no. That's what the doorman's for.
Question: how do you express disapproval of other children, of your elders?
Third Avenue answer.
If it's my papa, just keep quiet. But if it's my sister, I go like this. They call that the Bronx cheer.
Swank Gracie Square answer.
Well, I go to a progressive school, and they teach me if I don't like what other people are doing to just walk out and leave them flat.
Question: what do you think when somebody pushes you in the subway? Is it discourteous?
Well, gee, if you don't push in the subway, you never get where you're trying to go.
This week, after sampling youthful manners in a city of 7 million, WPA surveyors compiled their findings. Conclude that boys are more polite than girls. Slum children more courteous than the rich. The Chinese children the most polite of all. And American-born children place a doubtful sixth in juvenile politeness. 1938 marches on. Cairo, Egypt. A day of national celebration in the Valley of the Nile, the ancient city of the pharaohs.
His Majesty Farouk I, King of Egypt and Mesa, Lord of Nubia and the Sudan, is pleased to proclaim a national holiday on the 17th day of the month Zulqa'dah, in the year of the Hegira 1356, on the occasion of His Majesty's marriage to Safinas, daughter of Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha.
I, Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha, Senior Justice of the Appellate Court of Alexandria, hereby change the given name of my daughter, Safinas, to Farida, the only one, in obedience to the desire of my sovereign and of my future son.
To the police of Cairo, in order to demonstrate that the king and queen will have no more law-abiding subjects than the pickpockets of Cairo, my colleagues and I, El Nashal, promise by the beard of the prophet to abstain temporarily from all forms of lifting and thievery.
The day of the wedding of Farouk and Farida. To Christian bells, Muslim symbols and flutes, from the heliopolis of this home of Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha, a troop of red and blue uniformed cavalry escorts the curtained royal coach and eight through cheering crowds that jam back the streets of Cairo. Grinning fellahin from Fayoum, bearded sheikhs and their turbaned followers from the oases of Siwa, past the alabaster minareted mosque of Muhammad Ali, the bridal procession goes, past the foot of the Mokattam Hills and Saladin's Citadel. The green and white decked streets are thronged with Jews, Coptic Christians, Arabs, past 18-year-old Farouk subjects from the coast of the Red Sea, past Bedouins from Sinai, past camel drivers from the upper reaches of the Nile Valley, goes the royal coach. The domes and minarets of 100 mosques gleam in the sun. The bride's carriage rolls past the tombs of the Mamluks, on to Kubith Palace. Into the wide palace hall is led the girl bride Farida. Then the paths of the bridal couple separate, As she turns left into one chamber, as he goes on to the great drawing room, to stand before an all-male assemblage of princes and courtiers, with Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha facing the high priest of Egypt, the Sheikh Maraghi Al-Azhar.
Do you, Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha, take Farouk as your son-in-law and as husband to your daughter, Farida?
I do take Farouk to be my son-in-law.
Do you, Farouk, take Yusuf Zulfikar Pasha as your father and his daughter, Farida, as your wife?
I accept her betrothal to myself from thee and take her under my care and bind myself to offer her my protection. And ye who are present, bear witness.
Then I declare you to be united in one family and one blood through the maiden Farida. And I pronounce you father and son, according to the laws of the Quran and under Allah and his prophet Muhammad.
On the palace roof, an officer signals with a white flag. The waiting Cairo hears the salute, marking the end of the ancient Mohammedan ritual. A ceremony by which a 16-year-old commoner, Farida, named the only one, joins the select but dwindling company of eight reigning queens, four queen mothers left in the world this week of 1938. A ceremony making her the Queen of Egypt, with her boy king husband the first native independent Egyptian king and queen since Cleopatra. A ceremony from which the bride Farida is excluded. But today, says Egypt's queen,
of course I could not be right there, but I saw most of it from the next room, through the lattice. It was a lovely ceremony, and it was a wonderful wedding.
Time marches on. Tonight, first-run motion picture theaters throughout the United States begin their showings of the new February issue of The March of Time on the Screen. This new release, which marks the third anniversary of The March of Time on the Screen, is unique as a film record of one of the most important chapters in the history of our times. Entitled Inside Nazi Germany, 1938, it presents pictorially the effects on the German people of 5 years of Adolf Hitler's rule. This is the first film taken in Germany since 1933 to escape Nazi censorship. The editors of Time and Life consider the immediate interest and the historical implication of this motion picture document so great that the entire new issue of The March of Time has been devoted to this one subject, Nazi Germany. Says Film Daily,
The March of Time's new issue, Inside Nazi Germany, brings home the full truth for perhaps the first time.
Says Motion Picture Daily,
a notable film document which may well attain historical importance.
Knowing the provocative nature of the subject, The March of Time has done its utmost to give it an objective journalistic account of facts and conditions in Germany today. The city of Chicago's police department censors banned the film in that city for 2 days, lifted the ban only tonight under pressure of Chicago's newspapers led by editor Louis Ruppel of the Chicago Times, and on the written protest of the Civil Liberties Committee, the German-American League for Culture, and other local and national civic organizations. But in Philadelphia, reports the Pennsylvania State Board of Censors,
public showings of March of Time's issue on Germany would be most healthy. The picture should be widely shown.
After a Washington preview of the issue early this week, William E. Dodd, for the past 4 years the United States ambassador to Berlin, and today number one U.S. authority on Germany under Hitler, said of the new March of Time,
the members of every American family, young and old, who believe in liberty and democracy, should by all means see Inside Nazi Germany, which March of Time has so brilliantly produced. It tells the truth about Hitler's government.
This new issue of the March of Time will be shown during the next few weeks in more than 11,000 motion picture theaters throughout the world. We suggest you phone the manager of your local theater and ask him when he will play this latest March of Time on the screen. Inside Nazi Germany, 1938.
Starting next week, The March of Time on the air moves up one half hour to 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Next Thursday night on these same stations, 8 o'clock instead of 8:30, The March of Time.
Time marches on.
Time.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.